$155 million wonderland. As if by magic, 1,216 acres of wasteland have been transformed into the most stupendous exposition the world has ever known.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness the most excitingly different new concept in the history of television.
So you see, folks, all of you who are living in the year 2000 are fortunate.
I think it was back in 1944, wasn't it, Mother?
That's the most remarkable thing I've ever seen.
Did you happen to have a chance to watch the Snyder Cut, or
no.
Or have you just kind of experienced it?
I mean, not like the comic book stuff kind of completely misses me. I just know about this because people have been talking about it for years.
Oh, okay. So your whole experience with this is just through like the press and fandom, and really not even that much fandom because you're not really on social media anyway.
Yeah, not for that stuff at least. not for DC films. That stuff misses me all the way.
Yeah, it's more for, you know, posting your art and being that kind of stuff. You're not necessarily about this has got to be better than this thing or that thing. So the difference really comes down to tone. You know, like with the original theatrical cut, there were a lot of reshoots done, and the resulting film was a mishmash of tone. In particular, it was bringing in Joss Whedon to do what he did basically on The Avengers, but with DC characters. And that is not what that story was designed for at all. And he was kind of mishmashing stuff together and reshooting stuff. There was this very famous piece at the time where Henry Cavill was in Mission Impossible. And
the mustache.
He had a mustache, and they had to remove that.
Yeah, the studios were fighting over it, right?
It was a giant mess. Yeah. So this was kind of them kind of rectifying it and giving voice to a lot of the fans of Snyder.
He stepped away.
Like, hey, he should have had a shot.
His daughter died, right? Killed herself?
Yes, unfortunately.
Yeah,
yes.
Which is why
and
he
they,
left.
They tried very hard. They tried very hard to keep going, and they just couldn't do it. And the end resulting film and the theatrical cut was really like there was like dick jokes and stuff in it, and it was the tone was just wacky. It was almost like they were trying to go more for like what the style of the Suicide Squad trailer was.
Oh yeah, which
more than like trying to make a cohesive kind of film. Now, having said that, the Snyder Cut does have its problems. It's 4 hours and 2 minutes. That's really long.
It's 4 hours.
You know, that's Cleopatra long. It's 4 hours and 2 minutes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it is a slow burn. It actually kind of has almost like a 70s feel to it in terms of the slow burn, where there's a lot of character development for people. I mean, Wonder Woman's kind of sidelined, which sucks, but she still has some amazing scenes in it. And there are some really great sequences that were redone. Like now, like Superman has his black suit and everything. So, and it is a very cohesive, darker, more serious tone. Now, would I think it would have been as successful had the other theatrical cut not come out? No, I don't think so. I think people would have crapped on it. Had it come out, they still would have been like, it's super long, it's this, it's that, it's too dramatic, it's too this, it's a, what the hell is Warner Brothers thinking? I mean, that was the press at the time.
Well, he wouldn't have done a four-hour cut, probably, though, if it weren't for this specific circumstance, which is...
No, but he was fighting hard for three-something. He was fighting for, like, Inception length.
Yeah, I don't know if he's...
He really wanted long.
Now, how does that work with... So, when he stepped away... He did not intend to come back to it, right? He kind of let it sail?
Yeah, he was done. He had moved on.
And now, was this because of the fan upswell?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
That's exactly
it. So what is... I mean, has this happened before where a director gets to do a cut of a movie that's, like, not his?
Well, the thing is that it was his, right? That's, like, kind of saying that Blade Runner wasn't really Ridley Scott's. Like, it was... but like that would have been the equivalent if they were like, yo, Ridley, we don't like this cut. We're bringing in another director for your script and we're going to do these reshoots with Harrison Ford. Like that's what it would have been. It's that equivalent. So it's just that this has never happened, that you got to see another director come in and you got to see his vision for what he wanted the movie to be in an era where the studios have such tight control over the creativity of these guys, to the point where they're like storyboarding the movies and giving them a release date to the screenplay writers.
Well, essentially. How much of this is DC like floundering though? Because like, are they desperate to give the fans a less shitty but still shitty version of a movie they've been clamoring about that they got to sit down for 4 hours?
Well, this isn't necessarily DC. This is more Warner Brothers. And
sure, okay.
DC has tried to do its own thing, just like Marvel did, but it always felt second fiddle. I think that the Arrowverse has been done very well on the CW. I think that there are storylines in the DC comics that have a lot of fans behind them, but I just feel like Marvel stories are more relatable, and the way that they've done this formula is so unique and no one's been able to really replicate it. So
it's all very, I just wonder if it actually reminds me, I remember a couple years ago, Kanye West, he went back in and was editing songs from an album he had already released. And I remember noting that at the time, along with a bunch of other people, it was kind of strange because it's just a weird move for, I mean, director's cuts obviously exist, but this movie still, like, it's, the ink's not even dry on it, really. It's from a couple years ago, and he got
this is Zack Snyder's Life of Pablo. You're right.
and so he's dipping back into it. Based on like on fan reaction and stuff. And I remember when Kanye did it, I was thinking like, are artists going to do this now? Is every song going to be a living song? But that hasn't appeared to happen.
I had not made that correlation at all.
Yeah, I think it would be an interesting way for these, you know, auteurs, producers, directors, these people who are, you know, in control of their vision, if because I know the easiest thing in the world to say is like, oh, well, when I'm done the film, you know, it's dead to me. I'm looking to my next one. But I don't always believe directors when they say that, or writers. Like, I think if a studio especially railroads your vision, and you would always want a second hack at it. And it's just unique that he got it. And yeah, I wonder if you get enough power in Hollywood, if you could start having movies and you could just update them as you feel fit. And fiddle with them and put Easter eggs in week by week, or make it topical. I mean, I feel like there's endless possibilities to go with that. I don't think it's a good thing, but I think there'd be money to be made.
Yeah, you know, that's super cool. I think that that's actually a really cool thing to think about. Like I said, I never thought about that correlation between Kanye and Zack Snyder. I never made that before, but that really does make sense. I mean, like, he even has a black and white cut of the movie out now called Justice is Gray.
Wow. So he's double dipping.
Oh yeah, no, it's really kind of this swan song for the film that you don't usually get in cinema. I don't think we've had that in cinema before, and I think that's a great place to bring us in. Hello, everybody. 12 minutes in. Welcome to Guerrilla Film History. Now I'm Pete,
and I'm Mark,
and this is a show where two film nerds get together and reminisce about all the opportunities they missed.
What opportunities?
I just thought it would be really funny just to have it on a sour note for just one, and to see your reaction. You're like, wait, what did I miss? That was the best. Wait, oh no.
Yeah, I thought you might have dipped out. Opportunities. Well, they may be out there. I will fumble those situations if they do arise. I usually don't recognize them, so. opportunity. Yeah, I'll have to write that one down.
But yes, yeah, so what are we going to be talking about today for today's lesson?
So if you'll remember from last week, we talked about basically the advent of the movie camera. We were looking at the technology that allows us to make films, and watch films, project films, send films around. It's the device that, you know, is necessary to the art. Now, we are up to about the turn of the century, right? 1895 into like mid-1920s, I'm going to take us today. So it's like the first 20, 25 years of cinema as it kind of crystallized through the 80s and 90s. And by the 1900s, you're getting movies with plots. You're getting camera techniques are developing. And it's an exciting time. But what we also are going to get into is newsreels, kind of a forgotten piece of cinema, a piece of the arc of the history of cinema, and we're going to talk about it today. It's very interesting and has many correlations with what was going on in the world, which World War One was right smack in the middle of that. So yeah, we'll be talking about that today.
When you're talking about that beginning of cinema. Like, we did talk about those different inventions, like the chronophonographic gun for birds, and you have, like, the beginning of, like, that. So, but when you talk about the Luminary Brothers, right, and you're talking about, like, the beginning of cinema, I think we kind of touched on it a little bit, or maybe this might have been during kind of our brainstorming for the episode today, so I'm just going to kind of reiterate it. The idea that there was literal, like, live music, there was, like, a narrator, right?
Yes.
Like, there was that kind of stuff.
So
but at the same time, there was this you're talking about that there was also this kind of documentary push happening at the same time. So
yeah.
Where do you want to start?
Okay, yeah, well, because there's a couple things going on there. So yeah, the Lumiere brothers and George Melies, Thomas Edison was in this lot. It was an interesting group of people because they weren't even thinking of themselves as filmmakers. Like Etienne Jules Marie, who I discussed last week with that the modified gun to take pictures. I mean, he was an inventor and like a scientist. He wasn't a filmmaker, but he's crucial in that through line of from we were talking about the cavemen up until Transformers. So it's an interesting transition because a lot of these people they were there at the ground floor and they were the ones who were breaking ground on all these innovations. So George Melies was a magician. I'm not going to talk too much about him. There's actually if you watch Hugo, the Martin Scorsese movie, there's a very thoughtful character. George Melies is a character, and I think Ben Kingsley plays him. And it's just very – it's a loving depiction of the guy who kind of birthed cinema as we see it because Melies was amongst the first. As I said, he was a magician. He was a showman. So he was conceiving everything from the point of view of the audience at a theater and through the proscenium arch, the proscenium arch, like the actual – divide between the audience and the talent on stage. And now you have that with like the screen of a film. And so he was stumbling across camera tricks that were presenting themselves on film as magic. And I have in my notes here, it's kind of a funny term, Bushurst jam. So Bushurst jam is Bushurst jam.
Hurts.
Yeah.
Hertz, like Hertz as in this hurts me?
No,
or Hertz
like
as in
hearse,
like megahertz?
Hertz, someone who is, a corpse in the back of a limo, like a hearse.
Oh my God, yeah. That's even worse.
So, yeah, I have that in my notes because that is to tell me that George Melies was out and he was in Paris and he was taking footage. It might have been around the Eiffel Tower or somewhere, one of those beautiful, roundabout places where there's lots of traffic, and he's filming and his camera jammed. And what he had on the screen was a carriage, a horse-drawn carriage. And I guess after he knocked around the camera, it began to work again. But in that overlapping time, those couple seconds, the carriage had moved on. The people who were there walking had walked what would have been off screen. And so when the camera picked back up, it actually was an edit, which people weren't doing yet. These were mostly one takes. And so George Melies a carriage, and how he shot it when it stuttered, that a hearse would then appear. And so him, the magician, saw this little camera trick when he saw this carriage transform into a hearse, not in real life, obviously, but through the magic of cinema. And he then was able to reconceive his magic act with these editing techniques, and he could get ghostly apparitions to appear on stage. I know we talked about that through doing double exposure techniques. And he was just very innovative is the word. And it is notable that he was a magician because I'm not a magician, but it's a certain kind of creativity and it's a craft, right? You have to be good with your hands. You have to be good on your feet. You have to be able to present these ideas as a magician. he was able to do that, and him getting his hands on this camera and being one of the guys who was kicking off what we would get into in the 1900s, he's just really a perfect guy. And I would advise anyone who's listening, if you haven't seen Hugo, go watch it. It'll tell you everything you need to know about Melius. It's a little whimsical and maybe magical realism, but it'll give you the idea of the kind of guy who he was. And his counterparts at the time were the Lumiere brothers, and they were doing the same things. Part of what was happening was that if you had a camera, great, but you also need to figure out how to project it. And so I touched on that a little bit last week too, but this is essentially a technological arms race for who can get patents for these technologies, but who can get the people working on them. And Edison, of course, was the best at it because he had all the resources, he had the connections, he had the money. And so he set up shop in New Jersey, as I mentioned last week. That will be of note in a little bit when I talk about why the burgeoning cinema, the burgeoning film scene, they took up root in Hollywood. And it was a direct rebuttal of they didn't want to be on the East Coast because of Edison, because he was dirty. And so that's basically the turn of the century. I did leave listeners with the note last week that, yes, some of these films would have had sound if you were in the theater, and they would have been in color. And I was being slightly deceptive, like, you know, a magician. Thank you, George. And what I was getting at is that in the 1800s, when these films were first being presented, a lot of directors, Melius and the Lumiere brothers among them, would hand paint the frames. And so you would have not necessarily the whole film, not necessarily even every character or everything on screen at a given time, but you would have objects on screen colorized. And it's really cool looking because it is unnatural, but obviously life being lived in color with sound, they were striving for that, but they had to take an artistic approach. So that was a whole other like job that would have been on set, was someone, a painter, to come on and paint. Tedious, painstaking work, frame by frame. You would have to paint like you're animating. And so that's how you would get color on screen if you chose around the turn of the century. For a film to have the sound presentation, it has to take place in the theater, right? So you go to a movie theater in, say, 1907, there might be a guy on the microphone there because he might have lines from the movie. So when a certain guy gets on screen and starts talking, he'll talk. And maybe there'll be a girl there and she'll talk for the actors, or maybe the one guy doing all the parts, maybe they'll read the interstitial title cards. But it was more like almost interactive that way. And likewise, you would have sometimes like a 40-piece orchestra on hand, or as simple as maybe a guy with a violin or something. But you would have this accompaniment to bring these films to life. And it's just really cool because we are at the nascent stages. No one knew what this technology like was or could be. And like I said, it had all these different kinds of thinkers and people who came out of different professions. And they were the one who were, talk about opportunity, they were creating their own opportunities with this new technology. And it's, you can't talk about film history without this fertile time. We also get around this time the studios getting power and figuring out if they distribute and also exhibit all the films, as we call vertical integration is the term for that, you make all the money. There's no point on it that you don't make money. And so this is the time between 1907 and 1913 is the pre-monopoly.
So the pre-monopoly, when you say pre-monopoly, what does that mean?
So – well, we're engaged in something called it's the patent wars, right? And Edison's at the middle of it. He had the electricity wars with Tesla. We talked about that a little bit last week. Now he's at patent wars, and like I said, he claimed that he had a couple patents that would have been in anything that was anything called a camera at that time. He had little, I guess, screws or bolts or however it worked, but he thought he then owned a piece of every film made, basically. And so this guy was shooting for the moon. He was also aligning himself at the same time with a guy named Dixon who worked for him and was one of his projectionists and cameramen. He's also a guy who, because he knew what he was doing as far as editing and
Dixon cameras.
Oh, is there? I didn't even realize that.
Isn't there a Dixon Cameras?
Oh, you know what? Is that – maybe there is. Or shoot. Now I don't know.
If there isn't, there used to be. I believe there were Dixons.
Yeah, you that's got to be him.
Do a quick little look up.
Because he
– one second. I'm doing okay. It live. I'm doing it live, everybody.
Doing it live.
It's Dixon, isn't it?
This is Dickson. His name was W.L. Dixon, I believe. It's a funny name. But he was Edison's guy.
Dixon was Dixon, was Dixon Cameras.
Okay. Maybe it was a reference to him, but they had to change the name. Maybe Dixon still had them good Edison lawyers when that company was coming up. They had to change it.
Yeah, possibly. They must have, like, no, I mean, it's so vastly different than blah, blah, blah. And it's a, must have been.
And so Edison being.
But that's the first thing that came to my mind. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt destroy your flow and the show and everything. But I was just like, oh my God, I've got to, I know something.
No, there's no interrupting, man. This is a process. We're learning and teaching. Great. So Edison with Dixon, who was a former assistant of his, and eight of the major film studios, and also Eastman of Kodak Eastman, they all got together and formed something called The Trust, which was basically,
The Trust.
The Monopoly.
Brought to you by The Monopoly, part of the corporation.
Yeah.
Welcome to the state.
You are now an employee. But that is how they operate.
That sounds so evil.
Yep. And so, you got Edison right at the top of this with, eight of the studios and the people making film stock. So it was an effective
there
monopoly.
There was Johnny C, and he ran all of the cameras. That's why we called him Johnny C. C was for camera. Yes. And then there was Danny Two-Face, because it was really good at being happy and then real mad in the silent films, like those crazy guys you see in all those weird Rob Zombie music videos.
Well, it's just undiagnosed mental illness. That is what the silent era fed on. It was drunks. The liquor was just pouring out of their puffy cheeks, you know, those paunchy cheeks.
Welcome back, everybody, to Guerrilla Film History Now. I'm Pete.
And I'm McKinsey McLaughlin.
And we're in a newsreel. Because we're going to be talking about newsreels today. I do better voices than you, I think.
You do much better voices than me.
I'm going to toot my horn just this little teeny tiny bit. Just deet, deet.
Okay. They're great. I can do voice in my head and then somewhere on the way to my tongue, they just become an Australian accent. So I don't even attempt it.
It's like when Jim Carrey tries to do an impersonation of like New Zealand and he just does Australian in Dumb and Dumber. Let's put another shrimp on the barbie.
I thought you were going to say it's like when Jim Carrey tries to be in a good movie in the past 25 years and he just can't do it.
Oh, ow, dude. No, the Truman Show is really heartbreaking.
Yeah, like 25 years ago. My man hasn't had anything.
Oh, my God. Is it? Oh, man, it really has been that long. Are we that old?
We are advanced in wisdom, Pete. There is no
but
old. Not,
but luckily, we don't sound like those guys in those weird-ass newsreels.
No, not that like we old. I do usually wear a bowler hat and tuck in a press card, though, in the brim. But that's just
– No, you don't. You wear a trucker cap and flannel, and you go get kimchi.
I don't like kimchi.
The f*** you don't.
No,
that was the only curse word this whole time. We're not supposed to curse. I forgot.
We'll bleep that and we'll save it for when I talk about a William Randolph Hearst. There's some Hitler in this too. So
oh God, I didn't want to hear that.
Yeah, so we're gonna breeze by him.
I didn't want to hear that, man. Okay, yeah. So let's do news. So by the time the newsreels start, we're pretty much like in the silent era at this point, correct?
Yes.
Like we have the studio system and we're kind of glancing over that just because a lot of other kind of podcasts and stuff and other pieces have done this. But what we're trying to do here, and this is something that I talked about with Mark, and this is really Mark's impetus on this one, is to go, like, let's try going the more, like, what was actually going on in world history at the time route.
Yeah.
And see how that affected cinema.
If anyone listening wants to hear about the studio system, I mean, listen to You Must Remember This, Karina Longworth's podcast. It's great. She tackles all these issues. It almost makes it difficult to do these without redoing the work she's done because it's so extensive. But yeah, it's important to talk about these things. But like you said, a lot of them have been discussed at large, but I've never heard, like, newsreels seem to be this forgotten art form. But they were how people learned about the world for like many years, for like 50 years before they died out in the 60s.
Yeah, because I mean, like, at that time, I think a lot of people don't understand, like fluency in terms of, like, reading and writing for the mass population wasn't even really fully there. So those newsreels were sometimes the only way you could really get news, because sometimes you couldn't read the newspaper. You'd have to go off of, like, a newsy kid saying headlines on the street.
Right. Yeah.
Like that musical was based on real things. Like, that really happened. There were those kids. They were worked like that. It was terrifying.
And they rose up, right? So
yeah, and became Batman.
Right, yeah. Which, I mean, that's a rags to riches story for you.
Newsies is just the prequel to Batman Begins.
Yo, great. That would be fantastic universe.
He gets adopted by the Waynes.
Yeah, well,
that happens.
See, the last comic book movie I saw, and I will say comic book movie with denigration in my voice, is The Joker. And they had their own, I don't know, every movie has its different origin story. And I can't even keep track of which ones I'm supposed to know. So
the thing with Joker is that, like, that whole origin story could have been a complete ruse. It could have been totally fake. Like, the whole thing with the Joker is that he doesn't have an origin story. But we can get into that when we talk about comics.
Yeah, well, yeah. We will be talking about The Dark Knight for sure. Because that movie
at some point
had
on this podcast, we will talk about. But these newsreels, so do they start happening at the beginning of World War One? Is it
so
after World War One?
Yeah, it's just before. And it kind of – so like I said, that Edison in company – you know, kind of the villains in this story, at least from a democratic standpoint, they had this monopoly, the trust. And it was short lived, because what ended up happening was independents fought back. So people were striking out on their own. I have to mention here the names Charlie Chaplin and D.W. Griffith and Mary Pickford, because they were three. Griffith, who we'll glance over in a minute, but yeah, he was a director. And then obviously Charlie Chaplin was all things cinema, as was Mary Pickford. And these people were crucial, and they didn't want to play by the trust rules because everyone was getting ripped off by the trust. So they struck out and started their own production company that is United Artists, and that it's still around today. And that was their independent child then. So around that time is, as I mentioned a bit ago, people were settling in Hollywood because Edison and the trust and all those, you know, the East Coasters, it wasn't good for business, I guess. These people, I don't even know who they were, I guess future studio heads, but whoever was deciding where they were going to seize the land and make what became to be Hollywood, the center of the cinema world, they looked around the country, and it's California. They ended up on California because think of all you can see: mountains, rivers, forests, the ocean. Obviously, you got the vast beaches. There's all sorts of land, and you got the desert not far, so you could shoot any locale really, or at least fake it. And you get the warm weather. You're far from Edison, you know, so he can't send a spy into your ranks as easily.
Or can I? Yeah. As he has like a little fly, like a little steampunk fly, like little goggles on that have like little 18 bajillion little lights.
Yeah, yeah.
Flies in with a little solar sail on it, a little bronze solar sail. And it's just flying in and lands right on your little coffee cup. And you're like, what, one sugar or two? And then you put in the second one, it plops it, it just goes and flies into the tank.
A little stinger of direct current electricity. It was a form of advertising. And then it would fly off and kill an elephant somewhere. Because that's what Edison was having his people do to make Tesla look bad. I talked about that a little bit. Yeah.
I want someone out there listening to animate that fly and have that whole sequence like narrated by us. Like, I want someone out there to find this and do that for us. And I would love you. And send it to us, please.
I would do it. I don't even know how to log on to GarageBand though, so
I can't.
So I'm gonna move us along here quick because we are getting into the newsreels. But to answer your question, Pete, 1911 is when newsreels are considered to be, you know, invented, I guess, or first conceived. But that is kind of misleading because the very first films in spirit were what these newsreels became, because they would call them actualities, you know, like real life depictions. And that's as simple as something, you know,
actuality.
Yeah, it's
that's such a fun word.
It's French, like so much of cinema and film critic language. It's French. But yeah, so the actualities, you know, people walking through a garden to church on Sunday or the train pulling into the station. These were, in a way, something of what was happening in the world, right? A bit of a documentary, a bit of newsworthy. You have to make the connection. Again, we are jaded, right, from our standpoint nowadays. But it was if you're – you don't have the internet to go look at what a great – bear looks like a big black bear. If you've never encountered one in nature, you're maybe just not going to see one in your life. But you can go to the zoo now, right? Same thing with film. If you can't get to the zoo, you can get to the theater, and now you can see these elaborate magic shows, or a little bit later costume dramas and adventure stories. And you could be, you know, dropping yourself in a locale that you would never go, and it's like literature in that way. It's an escape, but you also have the world presented to you. And I say that very specifically because newsreels. What are they? They are reels of film filled with quote unquote news. They started in 1911. Like I said, there was a guy named Charles Pathé. He was a British guy, and he is considered the founder of the newsreel. He was actually a Frenchman. He did a lot of work in England, though. And if you go on YouTube, Pathé British is great, great. They have all sorts of old newsreel footage. And I was spending all night looking at that. It really when you watch these newsreels, they kind of whisk you away to some other time. Because these were silent, so they just have an eerie kind of feel to them, because they're supposed to be presenting the news, but the idea of what the news was, you know, as always, contested. So I talked about Edison and his evil ways. Well, we also have a figure, William Randolph Hearst, who presents himself here, because when you think about the early to mid 20th century, William Randolph Hearst has his hands in many pots. It's because he had lots of money and he basically owned the news, or a large portion of it. So he also, of course, was into the newsreels very early on. In fact, like 2 years in, he already had designs on his own newsreel, and he was collaborating with all of the big studios of the time to make newsreels for him. But just to jump back to the start, we have Charles Pathé. In 3 years, his operation of these newsreels, which he set up in the theater, was in England. Within 3 years, they were so popular, he had 37 cameramen and 60 officers around Europe and in the U.S. And so what this tells you is that there was a huge appetite for what he was producing. And so what was he producing? Well, it was the news per se, but like I said, this is the age of kind of yellow journalism, sensationalism. These ideas, like journalism, is still kind of in its infancy. So these ideas are still debated on what's news. And so anything and everything would make it into these newsreels. But the key was they kind of had to be things that were already planned, scheduled, because this equipment was so bulky. It's not like you can hear that there's a fire down the street and just run down and pull your device out. Like, these things had to be moved and set up and like loaded, and it was not quick. So like, what you could do is you can go to a baseball game and set up, because you know at 1:05 is the first pitch, and so you get there and you set up. Or you know a parade's going to occur, and so you set up your cameras. But yeah, it's very important to remember that. So there was no news breaking in these theaters, to say. And I have a great quote here. I'll paraphrase it. A journalist of the time was marking how there was an appetite to see the events of the day that you had read about maybe 2 days before or a day before, because the news, by the time they could get there and get the coverage of the story, they can get it out to the theaters within a couple of days. And so you could then see this news kind of come to life in front of you. And we live in the era of 24-hour news and CNN and god-awful Fox News, you know, Twitter, people get news on Twitter. It's a constant barrage of information. You can get swamped in it if you're trying to pay attention. But the scary part is then you have to start asking, like, where is this news coming for and who is it for? And I'm not going to get into any conspiracy theories here or anything. Don't worry. When we look back on this stuff and we see names like William Randolph Hearst and Thomas Edison, And they're collaborating with all the richest industrialists of the times. It's kind of a cornered market when you have something called the trust that controls the manufacturing of the film stock, and the actors are under contracts, and you can't transport certain things without getting Edison's okay. And like, you basically had to go ask permission from Daddy to get a second reel of film from Edison. He was trying to limit everything to one reels so they could have their own opportunities staying open. They didn't want anyone cutting in on their business. And
But then World War I happens.
Yes.
Right. And so what happens with that? Right. Cause now are you starting to get live footage, or does that not happen until later on? Or do they have small stuff enough for that?
Do
they have like
very difficult to like most footage from the war front, quote unquote? A lot of it's staged, like a couple days.
Wait, what?
Yeah, because like I said, with the it's so cumbersome with some of this equipment, and I mean, you got to think the communications didn't travel that quick. So like, when things are happening on the fly and you're trying to shoot something as, you know, static as war fighting, yeah, you can't really get what you want. And if you're doing that, you might get yourself killed. So, yeah, they would sometimes stage these things in the wreckage or something days after. And you go get a crew of soldiers and they play out a little thing. But, yeah, like, you're not really getting –
like some investigative discovery
marathon? Yes, yeah.
Like that kind of
– yeah, like – yeah.
And then when she came to the car, that's when things got really weird.
They do those, yeah, the reenactments. And so that's what they were doing, but
those pesky krauts and their little Meshuggah machine guns that they got there look like little car exhausts or horseless carriage exhausts. That's what they're called now in this era.
Horseless carriage exhausts.
I think. I don't know much about cars.
Yeah, neither of us are mechanics, are we?
This is a terrible impersonation of the man. It's absolutely terrible. But no, but seriously, so they were literally just dramatizing everything. And then but did people think it was real? Did they try to say it was real? Was that also faked, or was it pretty open that like, no, this is not real footage because we've seen the person that walks in the park last week?
Right. Well, yeah, I think these things were given a lot of like leeway in people's minds because it was all new. And so I'm sure it was very scattershot what people felt about the news. I mean, it's hard to say because some people, I'm sure, like, you know, think it's a fad or like, oh, these films, they won't last long. And obviously some people saw the future in it. What we do know is that movie theaters were popping up everywhere in America, across the world. England had theaters early because cinema, it's still an infant art form at this point. Governments, especially governments in wartime, were realizing that it is uniquely suited to disseminate wartime messages, basically to temper your populace's morale and deliver it information. Now, different countries had different ways of going about this, but you could see where it goes, where if you're in a crisis in a wartime situation and people are looking to their government to protect them and also inform them, they're gonna more likely believe what's being presented. And so, and especially when you have purveyors of filth like William Randolph Hearst, you know, the king of smear campaigns, and I mean, just go watch Citizen Kane. It's basically his life story. These things are going to get into tricky hands, and so it's hard to say what would happen if journalists got their hands on newsreels before some of these industrialists did. But this is kind of how it worked, and so. The news, what's the big critique of the news now? It's right. Everyone says it's six companies own like 95% of the information we get from the news. Isn't that kind of the trust? Like, how far are we away from the idea that these things are monopolized and to a degree controlled?
To a degree, right? Like, there are situations where, like, for example, Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. Right. Like that does have that kind of Citizen Kane feel to it. And I do believe that we're in the second kind of golden age of capitalism. You know, when you've got Elon Musk saying, I'm going to make sure there's a million people on Mars by 2050.
Yeah, we're in.
He tweeted out yesterday in response to Bernie Sanders that, what was it? Oh, yeah. My goal is to make life intergalactic, to spread consciousness to the stars. Like, that's literally what
that's horseshit. He's trying to get moon water to sell to you, and he wants Mars as his own escape pad because they know this world is burning. There ain't no million people going to end up in space.
Especially not on a dead rock.
You got my ears perked up because you mentioned my man Bernie Sanders, but I'm not going to weigh into that right now. I just warn people, Elon Musk is not your friend. He does not want to send consciousness to the stars. He wants to take money from you. Ask him why he doesn't pay for your health care if you're an American instead of putting a car in space or whatever.
But I mean, like, I'm only really drawing the comparison, you know, to kind of that stuff, because that at the time were the people that were able to afford the technology to capture these moments on film. Because it was such a new technology. I mean, it was the equivalent of a supercomputer.
Exactly.
You know, and that is literally the level of technology change that we're talking about. That's why film history is really that important. Because this is about the dissemination of information.
Yes, at its heart.
This kind of, yeah. So
the camera is a second printing press. It changed everything again.
Yeah, and you know, you're able to access people who cannot read.
Yeah, I mean, a huge part of newsreels is educational.
Powerful, powerful thing.
A huge part, mm-hmm. Like, I mean, think of PBS. All they do is make public broadcasting, educational documentaries, news programs for kids and for adults alike.
And you know what? And that is 100% warranted. But you have, like, YouTube channels, right, where you have, like, Kyle Hill, who has the facility where he's educating on science, even if it's through a pop culture lens. You do have dissemination of that stuff. Now we're in this kind of democratized world of cinematography and editing software and audio software and all this crazy stuff that we can do.
Yeah, there's no barriers to entry, which is great in my opinion. Everyone should have a podcast.
Really, the only barrier to entry, the only barrier to entry anybody really has is their lighting. Because, like, lighting makes or breaks the shot. And that's literally it. If everybody learned lighting, there would be very little difference between cinematic stuff that you see, like, in a theater or on TV, and the stuff you would
see. But Pete, see, you're missing something there. That's why you wear a V-neck and you distract people from the lighting. You just give them
how? Oh my god!
A little skin. Little chest hair. Just give them a little slice, not the whole pie, just a slice. And
just a little bit. Yeah. Just a little bit of the bear. Yeah. Just a little bear cup.
Yeah. Just
you don't want to let the whole grizzly out.
No. And then
we're
people,
not in Miami 84.
People would notice how horrifying the lighting is at that point. But if you just tease them a little bit, their eyes, they'll just focus on that. But that's just, I mean, that's why we're on podcasts here. When we get the video show up, I'm kidding, of course.
No. Mark would never agree to a video podcast.
No.
Me, on the other hand, 100%. I have a face for television.
Unless we can be in a room so filled with smoke, it completely obscures my face and jittery movements.
I'm being facetious. I'm not being serious. Like, I'm not at all. No, we're... But I mean, like, really, like, when we're talking about that controlling of information, I do think we do have to be careful to an extent, and I to be able to kind of take our view of the democratized world of cinematography, of film, and that kind of stuff, and put it on an era where it was literally the equivalent of a computer, where, like, the first ever thing where it was able to do this stuff. And we're talking about the first ever edited shot. I mean,
yeah, it's a mistake too.
It starts at first as a novelty, and then it turns, like, into an industry that's fueled by people who enjoyed the novelty.
Exactly. And an appetite that's changing.
Like, had they not really...
Constantly with culture, of course.
And the silver lining of the situation is that, you know, had they not invested the way that they did, had they not done the things that they had done, we wouldn't have any industry, right, at all. Because those guys wouldn't have been playing with those toys. They would have been playing with different toys, and art would have went in a different direction, you know. So, like, they might not have intended it to be the democratization of a certain art form. But what they didn't understand at the time is that the further and further away you get from a new art form, the more and more democratized it becomes. Because it's almost like the second law of thermodynamics, right? Everything kind of goes back to the law of entropy, where it become like every... If you go to... there was this great science show I watched one time where they go into... my God, what was it? It wasn't like Secrets... Wasn't it Secrets of the Universe? Maybe that's what it was.
Was that a club down in OC, Maryland?
No, there was this mining town, like, in the desert.
Mining town, I see.
Or, like, whatever. It was like an oil town or something like that, and, like, everything ran dry, and they just abandoned the town. It was a ghost town. But the desert is eating it up again. So there's all this sand everywhere. But that's basically what happens to everything. Everything kind of just goes back to dust, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So the further away you get from the beginning of something, right? Like, the smartphones were very, very unique in the beginning. Extremely unique, to the point where we're talking that Apple was really considering patent stuff the same way that Edison was, you know, because it's like, no, this is our design. This is our proprietary design. There's the phone, the way it works with the screen, all that stuff. Everything that you were talking about there, that re-happened again. And they knew once that became democratized, it was going to literally change the face of technology. Now you have a computer in your pocket. And now you have a computer on your wrist if you really want it to.
And think about, I mean, we joke that, like, we're two white guys that didn't have a podcast yet. And that, like, it's – the joke there being is that you can do one pretty easily, right? That obviously – like, Apple is the one – they invented the podcast basically. And they've kept it open source this whole time. And I think I read something recently that they're going to close it up.
The podcasts were for the iPod. That was the pod thing. Like, there was the iPod, there was the iPod Touch, there was the iPod whatever. Zoom showed up one time and then got made fun of in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. and that's like its little magna opus is like it's this little touchstone of technology that existed for a minute, like an A-track.
All right, so it's preserved in time.
Yeah, but I mean, like, so and now look at us. Like, we're on Anchor, right? And we're able to, like, literally just sign up and just do it and go. You know, and it's because we've gotten further and further away from the inception of the art. Because,
yeah, to your point, so the barrier of entry, we're not even talking about, like, so you could get your hands on one of these devices. Can you work it? Like, no, can you lug it around? Like, you need sometimes a crew for these projection machines or for these film machines. So, like, we are talking, like, labs with people. Like, this is – I mean, it does take these moneyed interests to bring in, you know, scientists and innovators and craftsmen, tinkerers, all those, you know, the crazy cast I had from last week. You need these things because it is at the ground level. And then once you get a little bit of control over the camera – from, you know, it, at first it was thought of, like I said, everything is a stage play. You're just fixing the camera there and the action plays out in front of you and the action's what's supposed to be compelling. But then you get, you know, F.W. Murnau is moving the camera around by the mid-1910s in German Expressionism. And it's wild that they're on they have what was I reading? They a ladder from a fire truck they were using, a crane, bicycle, wheelchairs, whatever, to get like a moving, smooth shot. They were using it because you weren't laying tracks yet, right? Because it wasn't not enough people were doing it. No one was making tracks to be laid and then the technology to do that. Like, but like you said, when you get further away from these things, these innovations get made and then popularized and then commodified, then you scale up. Here we are 125 years on, whatever it is. And it's an interesting question. Where do we go with a technology that is ultimately going to democratize all of our thoughts and our wishes to the point where, you know, everyone knows your phone's listening to you so it can advertise products you mentioned back at you and make them one click away to touch. And so we're not far from thinking, saying a thing, and then it's showing up at your door. Like, you can do that right now.
Yeah, but I mean, like, so now once we get it after World War One, though, right? Just to kind of jump back, I know abruptly back to the subject before we have to
leave.
I did want to touchstone on that, on the whole like idea of just, you know, the idea of the democratization of everything, but and on also kind of touching back on everything else we did. But just to kind of before we get going, like, you know, we get at the end of World War One, a lot of those innovations and the shrinking of that technology must have been fueled by the idea that we need to be able to get this footage live, right? Like, they must have been like, these people, like, we can't just keep staging war scenes.
Right. Forever. Yeah. And that was the concern, because if you're the government, what you're doing with those, it's exactly what that is. You don't want this novelty effect to wear off to where people are no longer going to buy these kind of clearly staged newsreels. And then what? Because if you're the government and you're using these newsreels as some form of propaganda. Now, I will say, like, propaganda doesn't have to be a bad thing. Everyone thinks, oh, propaganda, it's the Soviets, right? They're putting messages in from the satellite. Like, no, Thomas Paine, who's like one of our founding fathers, he was a pamphleteer who was rallying the troops for the revolution. He was a propagandist. Like, everyone loves him. He's a good guy, and he was a propagandist. If it's a bad guy, you think they're bad propagandists. But my point is that all these countries were using it for their own ends. And so, like, in Germany, kind of before and after the war, after World War One, that – they were reeling, no pun intended. And their cinema went in the direction of very dark, eerie, you know, the German Expressionism with those canted camera angles and the stark lines on screen. It's where
– yeah, the very harsh lighting. That's where you get like – yeah, I mean, Nosferatu isn't the best example of German Expressionism.
Well, Caligari probably is, at least one of the first. But
Caligari, yeah, that's the first. I would say that's the best, but I would say probably the one that probably people know shots from the most is probably from Nosferatu.
And that was –
particularly the shot of the shadow going up the stairs.
Yes, it's so creepy. Yeah, in the hand.
That is 100% a technique from German Expressionism.
Absolutely. And the funny thing about that is that he wanted to make Dracula. I believe that's F.W. Murnau.
Oh, yeah, no, that is Dracula. It's actually a very accurate.
But he had to. No, but he couldn't get the right, so he had to change it. Whatever. Six clicks to the left, so it wasn't a lawsuit situation. But yeah, he was able to maintain the spirit of it all of that, and this is what we're talking about. We're talking about innovation coming. You know, the necessity of the is the spirit is the what is it? Necessity is the mother of all invention. It's because they were figuring these things out on the fly, and you add a war. Like in Germany, like I said, the style of the films post World War I kind of got dark. But in around 1917, 18, their government took over all of the studios, and it was just one wing now. And I mean, it's easy to look at that and be like, wow, a pre-World War II Germany, post-World War I, and they own the information from their government. And it's just – it's one entity. And it's not hard to start thinking about the Putins and the – well, I won't say his name, but the fat f- who used to be our president. They use Kim Jong-un, right, in North Korea. They use their image. That's their bludgeon for politics. It's their image. You get Putin riding on horses shirtless and stuff. That's a ridiculous thing on its surface for a 16-year-old man to do. But he understands the power of him doing that, and it lets his people know, I'm a virile man. I'm out here on a horse going hunting. Teddy Roosevelt did this thing. It's the exact same thing. 1901. Some of those early Pathé films are of him on like hunts for whatever animals he was murdering that week. A lot of times bears, you know, a teddy bear named after Theodore Roosevelt. So yeah, that was Germany.
Snuggle with the thing I murdered.
And named after me.
Oh, look, I stuffed it just for you, little Jimmy. I shot him right in the eyeball. And then I put a little glass eye right here, and then the other eye I couldn't find, so I put a little button there, and then I stuffed it with a bunch of pillow stuff, which is why you don't have pillows.
You're talking in that accent, it's reminding me of the Wild Wild West, the Kevin Kline character. I still think we should just become a Wild Wild West podcast, but I'll have to work on you off air. I want to finish this up quick.
Go about it. We're going to call it Wild Wild What?
Wiki Wiki What? Wiki Wiki Why? So that was Germany. They had to almost take over their film industry because they were reeling from World War I, and they had all sorts of tumult and political assassinations and everything in their country. Now, around World War I pre and post, the French, what they were doing with film, aside from the newsreel and the kind of the propaganda efforts, was they started dealing – they were – it was called the film des art movement, and they wanted to get plays on the screen basically. And this seems to be a very snobbish, right, as the cliche goes, a French thing to do, an intellectual thing. And I guess you could mock that, but I'm thankful for that because that – again, we're talking 20 years after the device was invented, and it needed someone to come along and be like, hey, why don't we start filming these plays? It's kind of what we're doing already. And like, so now you have that. And like, I mean, every Oscar season, there's, you know, three Meryl Streep movies based on some play. And, you know, you got to go see them or pretend to see them. but that starts then with the French who decided to do that. And now for their part, the Soviets, right, after World War I, similarly reeling from the war front. And they also – I won't get into it, but yeah, Google the Russian Revolution and the Bolsheviks. Nicholas Tsar, so it's very funny about him. He was the one who was deposed. We'll say deposed. it's a nice, kind way to say what happened to him. But
yeah, no, it really reminds me a lot more of the Bruce Wayne thing we touched on earlier.
Well, apparently his last words were like, you know not what you do or something. So if you could just picture the Batman voice saying that, it would be pretty dramatic.
Rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a, pearls, pearls, pearls.
Okay, so yeah, the Soviets. So after the Russian Revolution, when the Bolsheviks with Vladimir Lenin and company took charge, they saw film as that's immediately what they saw it as a form to get the message of the people to the people, right? They were just victorious in a revolution. There was immediately a civil war, you know, a counter-revolution. And so they were fighting that off. When all that dust settled, what they were looking at was they didn't really have a pre-war film history, although it's a little bit of a little false. They're always perceived as like this backward nation, but they had like apparently up to 2,000 movie theaters before 1910. But the Bolsheviks, the Bolsheviks were able to set up film schools. Now this is important because once they went red, they were, you know, and they won their revolution. No one wanted to trade with them, so they couldn't get film stock and they couldn't get movies in. So they were kind of left with what they had or what they could get. So they set up these film schools, and this is why this stuff matters, because if you study film history, you'll know about the Soviet montage era in the 1920s. But that came out of these schools that were set up because they weren't making movies necessarily. They were studying films. The French were doing this too. It's what the French New Wave guys were. They were film critics, right? They were writing for Cahiers du Cahier or whatever. Cahiers.
Yeah. And then we'll touch on them.
And it's going to be a couple weeks. That'll be great too. But the Soviets, they had these guys who were basically technicians of film who were able to do these edits and stuff. And they were tearing apart films from around the world and reconstructing them. They were doing experiments that if I show you a bowl of cereal and then someone's blank face, are you going to assume he's hungry? Like probably. And like this is one of their innovations. And so they were working at this at like the abstract level. But then they were able to get
so that's how you start getting like the idea montage of, well, not just the montage, but also using editing to kind of elongate and change the pacing of a sequence and the tone of a
sequence. And show multiple storylines at once.
Because you could take the same clips and do it 15 different ways because you had this music scored to it. Now all of a sudden you're thinking about like, well, that person must be thinking about their like died loved one or something like that because of the sad piano music and they're stirring the coffee.
Right. And
but if you're stirring the coffee to like really happy, fun music, then it's the start of a fun day. Like that's all it really needed to be. So and then that's further democratizes the art form. And then are we shrinking down the tech at this time? Like on the Western front, like on our side, like, are we going like, hey, we need to be able to get live footage of these things and do this stuff. And because people want like more live stuff, they want to be able to see these things happening. Like we need smaller cameras. How do we go about that? Like, is that what starts happening?
Yes. Because by the time you get to Vietnam, they say that was the first war Americans watched on like TV every day. And I guess for live footage.
Yeah.
And to the point, these newsreels are kind of that idea. And it's different because it wasn't live, right? I said they were kind of rigged up and stuff, but
no. But I mean, they did have like film crews starting to show up, like in the like World War II.
Right.
Like, I mean, you started.
It's funny, actually. The Secretary of War for the British during World War I, he actually banned photography on the front lines for like a year, which is kind of a radical thing because if you think of what we think of as a free press, like you need them, you need the reporters and the photographers up there, but The British didn't know how to handle it. They didn't want to be creating propaganda because they thought they were going to be perceived as trying too hard. But the fact that they weren't, then it made them seem like, I guess, weak. And so they had to start producing propaganda, which kickstarted the Germans then had to look at it and the Russians, because like these things had to be recalibrated like war. This is a new arm of war is not necessarily these newsreels, but the ability to get to people, to get to their eyeballs. And the newsreels were a ticket into that, because this is how people were getting their information, aside from newspapers, of course. But newspapers were directly influencing the style of these newsreels. And
So by the time we get into World War II for next week, we'll also be talking about the Golden Age as well, correct? Like we're going to be talking about that big boom in Hollywood, because I mean at that point, you know, America is really starting to get this kind of luster in its kind of, I guess, self. We won the Mexican-American War. We didn't have to get involved in World War I too much. We did more like diplomatic stuff. The Roaring Twenties were starting to happen. Like things were starting to look up for the nation
till the Depression,
and we started. It's still the Depression, but I mean, like, there's still, like, there are things starting to move, at least in that direction. I think.
And culture thrived during the Depression, of course, arts.
Yeah, so maybe that's my perception of it, right? Maybe my perception of it is like the movies of that era and going like, oh, wow, look at the Roaring 20, da-da-da-da-da. But maybe that wasn't necessarily what it
was. I mean, I think, yeah.
I mean, like, it was kind of what we talked about.
And a lot of that stuff is like you see the Flapper Girls and Al Capone swigging whiskey with machine gun toting gangsters. And it's like that was – definitely some of the Depression, but it was also a lot of people on like dirt farms raking dirt back and forth, dying. And I mean, that one of my favorite movies, and we'll get to it with the American New Wave, is Bonnie and Clyde, because they actually have very sympathetic depictions.
Oh, yeah, the 70s.
Yeah, we're not robbing your money, yeah, we're robbing the bank's money, that kind of stuff. And they shoot up a house. But yeah, so I'm getting sidetracked. But no, that absolutely. And yeah, so I guess my final point here is just it's important to keep in mind, as I said last week, and I'm going to keep reiterating, is these technologies, they're made with people's hands, and then they have to be implemented in abstract almost. It takes – by the time we're in the 1900s, we're getting away from the technicians as filmmakers, and we're getting people who are you know, directors and writers and cinematographers. And so you can start thinking of cinema as a career, at least if you're in it. Before, that wasn't necessarily the case. I mean, newsreels, for example, they went a long way to help the perception of cinema being a lowbrow thing, because it kind of was a way. It wasn't like reading a fancy book, right? It was like reading a dime store novel, because you're getting these cheeky, entertaining things. They're frivolous. They're vacant, but that's like the joy of life. And so, like, I like these early movies, but then when you get to the newsreels, it helps the film and cinema. It gives it kind of a patina of
validity.
Yes, legitimacy and validity. And it betrays the idea of truth as much as it upholds it and enforces it, because it's a weapon, man. These cameras, they're weapons, and who wields them, who has the story, who has the narrative, that stuff all matters.
And I think we'll be able to get more into that next week for sure. And I want to thank everybody for listening to this week. Do you have anything to plug for this week before we let you go?
Yeah, my Instagram is at Mark Rubendahl. I put all sorts of weird art stuff and musings up there. And I'm also at I'm a member of a Right Brain Studio, so check that out too. And I'll have stuff coming from them in the upcoming weeks.
Awesome. And on my end, I have a short story out on Amazon. It is, if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, it's free for you to read. It's called Where Skin Once Was. It's a horror story about drug addiction. So it's a little dark, but I think you'll like the message if you go towards the end. I'd really appreciate it if you check it out. It would help to support the show by checking our stuff out. And make sure you let your friends know about the show. And, we'll check in with you next time. Thanks again.
Thank you.
The most remarkable thing I've ever seen.